let me start with this. Philippians 4:13. What does that say? Philippians 4:13. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Now, brothers, how do many Christians misinterpret that verse? It's all about me. Yes, that's right. The Bengals can do all things through Christ who strengthens them. How else is it misinterpreted? Other ways you've heard it misinterpreted. Okay? Yeah. Yeah, just like I said it, I can do all things. You guys are very familiar. The fact that you're so familiar with that verse is a clue that there might be a temptation or tendency that we have, Christians have, to take it out of context. Well, let me tell you a brief story. I became a Christian in my teen years, and in those years, I want you to picture me as a, let's say, 16-year-old pimple-faced boy, and I walked into the youth group room, and in front of me were two things. One was beautiful Sarah. Sarah was about 16 years old, too, and I was the shy kid, especially at that point. And Sarah was there in the corner. On the other side of the wall, it was actually a poster on the wall, was a picture of an athlete. It was probably Michael Jordan, dates me a little bit. And what it said on this poster, as you would imagine, is, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. So I'm reading the Bible in front of me on this poster. I'm influenced, obviously, by Michael Jordan's picture. And I'm looking at Sarah, so what do you think I did? I conjured up the courage, right, to go up to Sarah and asked her out. Now, she quickly rejected me. Well, this is what we sometimes do with a verse like that. So as pastors, we probably have a good grasp of this verse. We've been trained. We have the tools to be able to look at that verse carefully, and we're going to look at that in a little bit. But our people may not, right? So all they see when they look at that verse, perhaps, is the Thomas Kincaid picture, or maybe it's the athlete or something else. There's something else that is conveyed when they just look at that verse. You know, about 10 years after that moment, so I'm about 25, 26, I went through something very painful and difficult in my life. And during that season, it was this verse, and I'm going to say this paragraph, in the book of Philippians that encouraged me. And the reason it encouraged me is because I understood the passage in its full context. And I was taught, it wasn't something that I was interpreting, I was actually taught to understand that verse and see that verse in its right context. So it was from a sermon. It was preached about a year before this season of difficulty, but I pulled it forth from my memory and it encouraged me deeply. So, brothers, there's a danger when we isolate a text, when we read a passage apart from its surrounding context. We may actually miss the point. There's gold in the passage. We saw that in 2 Corinthians 5:20. We got to find it. And one of the things that we need to do to find it is consider the context. So, let's review just briefly. And again, we just did this just a few minutes ago. So, one of the things I wanted to talk about briefly, and this is more parenthetical, but this is my process as I'm working through from Monday through Friday afternoon. I try to finish my draft Friday at noon. So what I try to do is I try to work on the text, applying structure, context, etc., and trying to get to the message to them then on Monday and Tuesday. So that's what I'm doing. I'm dedicating that time to that. If you guys have other pastors or assistants or interns, what we do is we have a few pastors and we have a few other guys, former elders, that will join us for this. We have a teaching team meeting on Monday. And so on Monday, we take about 15 minutes to review the sermon and the service from Sunday. Then we take about 45, 50 minutes to talk through the passage that's coming up for Sunday's message. And so whoever's preaching presents a very much kind of a Simeon Trust-like sheet to the rest of the guys, and we just talk through the passage. So that kind of gets me started. I do a little bit of work on Monday, and I really focus on the message to them then. And then I start to do theological reflection and some of the homiletical stuff Wednesday, Thursday, and then Friday morning. You guys may have a different rhythm. For me, it's helpful to sit in the text like that. I know some guys, do work on like 2 days. They get everything done in 2 days. I can't do that. Maybe I'm just a slow thinker. I need it to kind of settle into me over the course of about 5 days or so, 4 or 5 days. So anyway, just to encourage you guys with that. What is the definition of expositional preaching? How would you guys define that? Somebody give us a definition. Yeah. So we heard this from Jim just a few minutes ago. The main point of the passage, it's the main point of the text, and I like what Jim said. He expanded on that a little bit. You want to carry a whole lot of things from the passage into the sermon. So the structure, the tone, I appreciated you saying that, the tone of the passage, the structure, the intent, the burden of the Apostle Paul. What is Paul doing with the content that he is describing here? He has an aim there. He's trying to do something with the content. So you want to carry all of that across into the sermon. And one of the things that will help us do that is context. So what is the principle? If you're taking notes, jot this down. Here's the principle. We must understand how the original audience understood a text in order to know how it applies today. We must understand how the original audience understood a text in order to know how it applies today. Now, what is the value for the preacher or the Bible teacher or the small group leader? Why should we do this very important work? I'm going to get to this chart in a second. Let's talk about the value first. Well, the first thing is obvious. We've already talked about it. It provides us with greater accuracy and precision. If we want to handle God's word well, this is an important tool to use. And we've already seen that demonstrated in 2 Corinthians chapter 5. But it also brings you into the flow of the author's argument. And in an epistle, for someone like Paul, when we're examining his work, this is so crucial. It's absolutely essential that you understand the flow of Paul's argument, not only just the 5 or so verses before, but really the whole letter. That's so crucial. We're going to see that in Ephesians. We saw that in 2 Corinthians as well. It also helps you understand difficult parts of your passage. You may get to a text. What does this mean? Well, looking at the context will clarify for you. What does this difficult passage mean? One of the things that context is helpful with is it allows you to let the biblical authors themselves to do the hard work of interpretation, right? So we're going to see in an example here how Paul does that for us as we're trying to understand Ephesians. But whether it's a Old Testament allusion, whether it's Paul interpreting Paul, this is crucial stuff, right? So we want to look at context. So there is value. How do we do it? Well, you'll see this chart on the screen. There's various contextual layers that we want to acknowledge. So we want to read the corresponding biblical sections in this particular manner. Here we go. Okay. So you got a text in front of you. What do you do with it? Well, the first thing you want to do with it is consider the literary context. So we're kind of working from the text outwards like this. Oh, I can't draw on this. Let's see. Yes, I can. Okay. So you want to work from the text outwards. Whoops. There we go. Like this. Okay, so the first contextual layer that we want to consider is the literary contextual layer. So these are the words around the text. So the immediate context is, and as I mentioned just a minute ago, the whole, kind of the big picture, in this case, of the letter. So what role is our passage playing in the wider letter? So we're looking for the flow of argument, as I mentioned before. So with a partner, I want you to think through this a little bit. So think through, how might you divide the book of Ephesians? Okay, just from your general knowledge, maybe you're not as familiar with the book, that's okay. But just with the people around you, how might you divide the book of Ephesians? What are kind of the sections, the major sections of the book of Ephesians? I would encourage you to look at it maybe chapter by chapter or maybe in two halves. Okay, so go ahead. Just take a minute to do that. All right, for the sake of time, I know I didn't give you a ton of time, but we're going to keep plugging away here. So bring it together. Let's bring it together, and let's talk about this a little bit. Let's kind of start really high level. So how might you split this up in two sections? Go ahead. Yes. Yeah. Excellent. Excellent. Anybody else have anything to add to that or subtract from that? Hopefully not subtract. Yeah. That was really good. Yeah. So you've got theology and you've got practice, lots of ways of kind of articulating that. We don't want to be too simplistic, even as we kind of split that up. So let's look at just chapter by chapter, okay? So again, there's a danger in doing this because we are not maybe capturing the entirety of each of these chapters, but let's try to think chapter by chapter. Okay, so I'm assuming you've read Ephesians at least a few times. You're familiar with it. Obviously, you're familiar with your passages. Ephesians chapter 1, these are just some ideas. Don't take this as the answer or gold, but just to get us thinking, right? So Ephesians chapter 1, what do we see there? We see that we are blessed. Ephesians chapter 2, that we are saved. Ephesians chapter 3, we are a new people. Ephesians 4 and 5, we are a peculiar people. We're called to walk worthy. This is in light of what our brother just said. We're called to walk worthy of what God has done for us. Ephesians 6, we are an embattled people. So the language from walk turns into now you stand, and you hold the ground that God has given you. So that's an idea of how you might split the book up. You might have different categories, or you may answer that question differently. That's okay. But again, we want to do this kind of work. So one of the things you want to do is read the whole book, right? Read all of Ephesians. You want to read it lots and lots of times. And then you might come up with some headings like that. But what we want, as you're looking at your study sheets, the sheets that you're making for small group discussions, what we want for you to especially focus on is the immediate literary context, what's before and after, okay? All right, let's go to historical and cultural. Now, what is this? Well, historical, and the way Simeon Trust defines this is interesting to me. Jim, I don't know whether you find this interesting. They split up historical and cultural. We just want to be clear with definitions, but it's helpful here with Ephesians. They're kind of one and the same. So historical is the world of the audience of the text, okay? And cultural, as defined by Simeon Trust's leadership, is the world of the text. So the terms and the concepts in the passage that need to be understood in order to understand the passage. Right? But with Ephesus or with the epistles, they are one in the same. That's kind of nice. Nice for us, right? Can you guys think of where we would need to separate these two contextual layers? Where might we do that? What was that? Yeah. Yeah, Gospels, right? You've got the world of Jesus, and then you've got the audience that Matthew perhaps is writing to, and so forth. And so the goal here is to understand the historical situation, the circumstances of the audience, that kind of thing. So Paul's letters are often occasional in nature. You think of the letter to the Philippians and so forth. Ephesians, if there's a spectrum of occasional, there's a situation behind it, and not so much occasional, but more like a tract, where would you put Ephesians? Occasional or more like a tract, right? Yeah. So there is some occasion. There's certainly a history there. There's a people that he's writing to, and yet it's less occasional in nature. Okay, so with your partners at your tables, here's another question I want you guys to think through. What do we know about Ephesus, and what do we know about the Ephesian church from the letter to the Ephesians, as well as Acts chapter 19? So I'm just trying to help us gather some knowledge here about Ephesus and the audience, okay? So at your tables, please talk through that. What do we know about Ephesus and the Ephesian church from the letter as well as Acts 19? Go ahead. Okay. Let's come together, brothers. Let me ask you guys, I know we're doing this quickly. I realize that, maybe some of you haven't read Ephesians recently or outside your own passage, and that's okay. But just from our kind of collective knowledge here, what do we know about the Ephesian church? What do we know about Ephesus from Ephesians as well as Acts 19? Yeah. Where are you getting that from? Yeah. Okay. Yeah, good. Good. Excellent. Yep. Yeah. Now, where are you getting that knowledge from? Okay. 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 That's good. So some of what you were saying early on is coming from probably some reading that you're doing on the historical situation of the city of Ephesus, which is okay. We want to start with, what does Ephesians say? And I'm not trying to criticize you personally. We all have that knowledge in our heads, right? So we want to start with, what is in Acts 19 in this particular case, as well as in Ephesus? What clues do we get? What can we mine from those places to kind of paint the picture of Ephesus and the church? But I think it's okay to go to some historical records, too, so that's helpful. Anything else that you guys have mined from Ephesians or Acts 19? Okay. Okay. Yeah, I think that's right. And we talked about this a little bit yesterday as we were studying too. But I think there's a major concern here for Gentile inclusion, right? And so we're seeing that. We see that in the pronouns that he uses. Sometimes he says we, and he's referring to the Jews and me, Paul. And then he'll say you, and then he'll say us. We're all together, right? We see that especially in chapter 2 and so forth. So that's important. That's good. Here's another important motif. If you read Ephesians several times, and if I asked you, hey, pick out a repeated word or concept, what would come to mind? What might come to mind? Okay. Grace, okay. Reconciliation, okay. Unity, okay. What about power? I think somebody counted this. I didn't count this, so I probably should have counted this. But somebody counted 28 references, direct and allusions to power and authority in Ephesians. Okay? So why would he be talking about power, power that comes from God, the strength of his might, that they would know God's power? All over this letter in light of what we saw in Acts 19 as well, right? So these are questions. Again, we're kind of filling up the picture of what is going on in this letter based on what we see in this church, right? So power is an important motif to consider in this letter, as well as we're considering Ephesus. Okay, let's go to the biblical context. What is the biblical context? So the literary context is the words around your text. Historical, cultural for Ephesians is the world of the audience, okay? And what about the biblical context? Well, we might say it's the entire word and your text. The entire word and your text. So we're looking for whole Bible connections here. Whole Bible connections. So we're drawing on literary or historical connections between the books of the Bible, right? And I want to draw a distinction here from biblical context with biblical theology. There's overlap, and we see that even in Ephesians. But what we want here, especially in your study sheets as you're working through that, what we want here is not biblical theology. That's more that theological reflection piece. That's an important part of our study. What we want here is more related to quotations, allusions, citing other authorities, citing other authors, that kind of thing. Okay, so when you're working in Ephesians, you want to ask yourself the question, where have I heard this before? This sounds familiar. Where have I heard this before? So, an example, Ephesians chapter 1, that prayer at the end of that chapter, 15 through 23, there's a quotation there. There's an allusion there to a psalm. Okay, so again, that would be an example. One of the brothers pointed out yesterday, one of the small group leaders did Ephesians 2, 11 through 22. And there's language there, and you're kind of like, that sounds so familiar. There's something I've read in, where have I read that? Isaiah, right? And so you want to see some of those connections and ask yourself, how is Paul using this biblical allusion to strengthen his point and his arguments in my passage? Okay, so let me ask you guys this, and this is just for all of us. What are some strategies? What are some ways we can go about finding the context? Knowing your Bible, yeah. I mean, if you're wondering, hey, why should I read through the Bible maybe every year or consistently? Here's a great motivation. You want to know your Bible well so that you can have some, you can kind of enhance those instincts, right? What else? Okay, what do you mean reference marks? So like cross-references, yeah, okay, good. What else? Yeah, okay. Knowing the language can be helpful. Yeah, any other strategies? Yep. Okay, okay. Now, again, we're thinking context. So context in particular, what can help us to apply the tool of context or to understand the context of the passage? So, you know, some of this we've already said. So reading the passage before and after, reading the entire book several times, looking for common themes, common motifs, that kind of thing. Reading the corresponding biblical section. So obviously the book of Acts for Ephesians or a portion of that. And so we want to let the Bible, and I said this earlier when I was talking to you, we want to let the Bible first fill in the historical picture, but then we want to allow other sources perhaps to enhance or strengthen or sharpen the point or confirm, right? But I think we need to start with the scripture and then, of course, consider, like I mentioned, allusions. All right, let's practice this. So flip over to Philippians chapter 4. Okay, so let's... I want you to help out 16-year-old Godwin, okay? So what I want you to do with the people at your table, I want you to read this text in its first literary context. So we're going to apply that particular tool. So look at the surrounding verses. What do we learn? Okay, so go at it with your tables. Just a few verses before and after. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I know we're moving quick here. Okay. So what do we learn as we're looking at this passage as a whole? What do we learn? Ain't about football. Yeah. They were concerned for him. They were concerned in particular for his lowly situation, his lowly state, right? It says after, I think it's the verse after, yeah. Yet it was kind of you to share my trouble. Okay, we're learning something. Okay, now let's apply the historical context or try to look at the historical context. So at your table, what is going on in the Philippian church? And I want you to consider, again, Acts, Philippians itself, as a whole, and maybe look at some verses prior to this. What is going on in Philippians as a whole that would color what we see here about Paul as well as the Philippian church? Okay? Go for it. Hey, for the sake of time, let me actually just point you to the book of Philippians. Don't look at Acts, okay? From Philippians, what do we learn about the historical context? Okay, go ahead. Sorry about that. Give you another 30 seconds here. Okay. Looking at Philippians itself, what can we put together about the Philippian church and Paul? Go ahead. Okay. Okay. What else? Yeah. Yeah, so 4:2. You've got discord, a very particular example of that. It's implied before, right? I mean, he's talking about, gosh, chapters 1 and 2, his example, Epaphras' example, Jesus' example. Y'all need to be servants to each other. So it's implied before, but it comes to a point here. There's a particular situation of discord. Okay, what else? Okay. Thanksgiving for sending support, is that what you said? Now, why is that especially meaningful? Paul's in prison, and what can we gather about the Philippian church's situation? Yeah, where do we see that in the text? Okay, yeah. That's right. That's good. Do we see it implied here in Philippians? Yeah. What does that say? You want to read it for us? Yeah. Yeah. You see it there. You see it implied in our passage 10 through, let's say, 20. In other words, why is Paul saying what he's saying, right? What else do we know about this church? What was that? Yeah. Okay. Partnership. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Paul's situation. So chapter 1, verse 13, Paul is in prison. In the church, chapter 2, verse 26, Epaphras is sick. False teachers are spoken of in chapter 3, verse 2, right? So, you put this all together. Here's a church that's impoverished, at least materially, likely. There's discord. Their main guy is in prison. Epaphras is sick. There's false teachers. This is a really difficult situation. So, it makes sense to ask the question, how are these guys going to survive? How are they going to maintain and sustain joy? So let's put this together. So if that's kind of the broader historical context of the church, Paul, Philippi, what can we learn now about our verse, chapter 4, verse 13, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Yeah. Yeah. Good. Yeah, so this isn't, this verse isn't about achievement. This verse is about survival, right? So we might paraphrase it this way. Paul is saying, I can endure all things, all kinds of circumstances through him who strengthens me. Or I can survive all kinds of circumstances and situations through Christ who strengthens me. In other words, I needed this verse after I asked Sarah out, not before, right? There's the punchline. Okay, turn to Ephesians. There's all a setup for that. I mean, Ephesians chapter 6. I want you to look at a few verses here. Here's a passage we're not going to look at in terms of in our small groups, okay? But I want us to look at this. And I want us to look at this and really examine the broader literary context to help us understand this passage. So I'm going to read this passage, and I'm going to write down some verses, and I want you at your tables to kind of examine this section. So Ephesians 6, we're just going to look at 10 through 13, so not the entire armor section, just the introductory parts. Finally, be strong in the Lord and in the strength of his might. Put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the schemes of the devil. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the cosmic powers over this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places. Now, my question is, what is the function of this final section in view of the rest of the letter? Okay? So we're just going to look at these three verses. What is the function of this kind of final section, this concluding section of thought and instruction and encouragement in view of the rest of the letter? 5.5 chapters or so, okay? So I'm going to put down some cross-references essentially for you guys, and I want you to look up these cross-references. And the question is, what do these cross-references tell us about these particular verses, okay? So the first one is 119, 316. I apologize for my terrible handwriting. Okay, so 13, 121, 22, and 310 is the last one. So at your tables, look these up, compare them to chapter 6, 10 through 12. What do we learn? It's a 414. All right, I'll give you about 30 seconds here. Okay. So hopefully you looked up at least some or most of those verses. What can we gather about 6, 10 through 13 based on what Paul has already taught? Okay. So you're saying there's a corporate element here. It's a corporate fight. Is that what you're saying? Okay. Okay, good. Okay. Yeah, somebody, go ahead. Okay. Good. Yeah. Interesting. So the battle, I think you would affirm this, the battle here is not only spiritual in nature, but it's also doctrinal. Which, obviously, there's overlap there. Yeah. 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 That's right. Yeah, so we're in application, right? So Paul is applying. Yeah. Anything else? What else did you guys mind? Go ahead. Yes. Good. Yes. Yes, excellent. Great observation. I hope you guys heard that well. You want to say it again a little louder? It's good. Yes. Very true. Yeah, I can tell some of you guys want to preach, and I like it. It's good. No, seriously, it's really good. Encourages me personally, too. Yeah, and we've already talked about the historical context a little bit and this idea of the power motif that's here. And specifically, I mean, it's just fascinating to me how what Paul focuses on through this letter is not just power in general, but it's the location of that power and the means of that power relative to, well, let me ask you this question. As you're looking at verse 12, where are the evil forces? Isn't that interesting? Now think back to chapter 1, verse 3. Okay? Who actually rules in the heavenly places? Jesus does, right? So it's our union with him that gives us encouragement, but it not only tells us that we're blessed in the heavenly realms, but that we are protected and defended. We have resources for the war in the heavenly realms, or from the heavenly realms, because we are with him, we are seated with him there. So there's so much there to unpack, but I want you to just notice, if you compare verse 1, chapter 1, verse 3, chapter 6, verse 12, one says Jesus rules in the heavenly places, and the other says you've got some other people in the heavenly realms too. It's not cool. It's not good. It's bad. There's a battle. So what did I wanted to point out to you guys? We're looking at this passage. We're going to come to a close here and take questions for 5 minutes. But you cannot preach Ephesians 6:10-12 or the following section accurately without recognizing really the whole book. In fact, as you go into the armor of God, what are some biblical allusions that are found in the armor of God? Where do we first see the armor of God in the Bible? Isaiah, right? And it seems to be, and this is somewhat controversial, but it seems to be the armor of the Messiah, the armor of the servant. It seems to be the armor of Christ that he uses to save his people. And it's almost as if he hands it to his people to continue to use in our war, in our battle. Now, that's just me quickly applying something. But my point is there's something there. There's something there to look into.